Welcome back to I'm Sorry, Dad. If you're in the Los Angeles area, I have a stand-up show Tuesday, August 6th at the Hollywood Improv. If you want free tickets, DM me on Instagram at Rydune. That's Tuesday, August 6th, 9:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Improv. All right.
Support for I'm Sorry, Dad comes from Manscaped, who is the number one men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels.
You ever hurt your fucking balls when you're manscaping? It's happened to me quite a few times. There I am walking down the street, yada-da-da-da, trimming my bush. Boom! I cut my balls. And I'll tell you something. It stings.
And that's why I love Manscaped.
All right, I said that in joke form, but I have indeed injured my testicles while trimming my pubes. And it's actually more uncomfortable than this advertisement.
And that's why I love Manscaped.
And that's also why Manscaped has redesigned the electric trimmer. Their Lawnmower 2.0 has proprietary skin-safe technology, so this trimmer won't nick or snag your nuts, dude. Manscaping accidents are finally a thing of the past. And don't use the same trimmer on your face as you're using on your balls, you sick fuck. Manscaped also has the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Why are you not putting deodorant on the smelliest part of your savage body? Always use the right tools for the job. Your balls will thank you. Our listeners get 20% off and free shipping with the code SORRYDAD at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use the code
SORRYDAD.
On this episode, we have returning guests John Walkup and Kenneth Beckerdyke. Spoiler alert. I can't say that. We spoil the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Well, review it, and in doing so, we spoil the fuck out of it. So, if you haven't seen the movie, just go to manscaped.com and use the promo code SORRYDAD. Ha-ha! And go see the movie. It's really good. I loved it. And I didn't really know much about the Sharon Tate thing, and I'm not like a fake film buff like Brandon. Brandon pretends to be a film buff because he's insecure about how unintelligent he is. All right, enjoy this episode, spoil-filled, with John Walkup and Kenneth Beckerdyke.
Brandon's crazy, right? He's very sad. I'm so sorry, Dad.
We are here with John and Ken, back at it. With a vengeance. Die Hard with a Vengeance is the movie we are reviewing today.
John and Ken with a Vengeance.
You got it.
John and Ken.
Love it.
How are you guys doing?
We're doing good. You know, a little, you know, burned out from how Laugh Boys didn't perform as well a second time. So we're just sort of recovering from that.
It was a real bummer for me.
It actually got more views this time.
Oh. But that's good then.
I have more followers.
I think we just need to keep posting it.
Than a year ago, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you should do. You should send that clip to every huge social media person, like Logan Paul or all those guys, and just see if they what did they do with it.
Be like, hey, do you want this? And then they're like, who is this?
They're going to be like, how'd you get this footage of us?
I get it.
Right. Wow.
Gotcha.
All right, guys. We all saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
We did.
Fuck yeah.
That's why you guys are here, because you're... The two filmmakers, two people that appreciate it a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking us back.
Yeah, we're really glad to be here.
Let's all start with a one-word review. Ken, I looked at John. John, one-word movie review.
Exciting.
Ken?
Bromance.
Is that an opinion?
It's just an objective fact.
Okay. Brandon?
Feet.
Ooh.
Oh.
Like feet as in what a great feat.
Yep.
Okay.
That's what I meant.
My review is excellent.
Wow. Oh.
Second word, captivating.
So wow.
You got two words.
You can get two words?
Well, I'm your boss.
What? They're not.
He is paying us to be here. Am I the only one getting paid for this?
I am notorious. Infamous for hating long movies, but this one, did not disappoint. I was captivated the whole way through.
2 hours and 45 minutes.
What's a long movie that you hate? What's one? Can you give us an example?
Midsommar.
Okay. You didn't like Midsommar?
I liked it, but it was too long.
Go fuck yourself.
I didn't even see it.
It was too long.
Heating it up.
So talk about the fucking movie.
Have you ever seen Magnolia? I just want to ask.
Oh, my yes. God. Okay,
that's fucking... That is a... That's, whole damn.
There's a whole dance number in there.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that in years.
Yeah.
Talking frogs.
If you want to talk about
crazy.
A cats slog. And dogs. If you want to talk about a slog, then you get that one. But, all right. So I think everybody here, I don't know, Rye, if you're like the biggest fan of Tarantino.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I feel like most people are. But I feel like us three, we were like kind of, because I feel like he's been influential for a lot of us.
Yeah.
In a way.
I've like, for the first 5 or 7 years that I wrote anything, it was just stealing his shit.
Yeah. That's like, just how it works. True,
yeah. Yeah. It was just stealing that. I was honestly like, Kill Bill is really what got me into being like, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Was the first time I saw it. And yeah, that's just fun. So Tarantino's got a special place in my heart.
Yeah.
It's hard not to like go back to his movies and sort of like just fill up the tank on like his stuff. You know what I mean? Like I remember when Django came out and I was just like just kind of obsessed with it. You know, I remember watching it for the first time. I think we probably went to see it together.
Yeah.
And then like just going back the next like next couple of days and there's just so many like Rye saying it's like very captivating. It's like there's just so many little moments. Like, if you remember when Django's, like, Christoph Waltz's character tells him, like, hey, you can wear whatever you want.
Yeah.
And then he picks, like, the blue-ass, like, suit, and he's, like, right, just cuts, and he's on the horse, and he's, like, it's just, there's just so many great feel-good moments in his movies.
Which I didn't, actually, this is just a little side note, but that same outfit, I'm pretty sure Roman Polanski wears that in this, movie. Do you remember that?
That makes sense, yeah.
He's wearing that, like, puffy thing, like, his chest is all, just like a weird...
Yeah. It's like an Austin Powers outfit.
Yeah. But yeah, no, there's all those like, I was just watching Django today before I came here. Mm-hmm. And there's like a lot of little shit that you don't really pick up on when you first watch it. And, but the thing is that, you know, his movies now, at least they're fucking long. They're very, very long. Like Django's 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Hateful Eight was 3 hours and 10 minutes or just 3 hours?
It's a little under 3 hour, I think. And then they just did that Netflix version of it where it's like 50 minute episodes. So it's like 3.5 hours long now, but it's broken up into four episodes. I haven't seen that version of it yet, which I actually kind of think is an interesting way to watch that movie. Mm. I just rewatched Jackie Brown because this one, a lot of people were saying it was like the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was more like Pulp Fiction. I didn't really read that. I read it more like a Jackie Brown.
Yeah, it feels like Jackie Brown mixed in with Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, I mean, Jackie Brown is obviously not as violent as...
Like, as this one.
Well, I mean, I feel like he, after Kill Bill, he just was like, fuck it, I'm just going to go balls to the wall. I'm just going to start cutting off arms and limbs and legs and blowing people out fucking doors.
By the way, anybody listening, if you haven't seen the movie yet, we're probably just going to... spoil it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's kind of hard to talk about it without spoil. I mean, we gave a one-word review. I mean, everybody here, I'm pretty sure we all, like, liked it a lot.
I fucking hated it, man. I saw it twice, and the second time even pissed me off more.
I'm going to say spoiler alert in the intro.
Oh, okay.
Spoiler alert.
Wow. Yeah. That's so generous of you.
Right there. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like, it seems like all of his movies, like you said, after Kill Bill, they have a sort of structure to them where it's just like, build up of tension fueled by dialogue that's really rich, and then you get to this explosion, and then it ends, which I didn't realize until after I went back and watched all of his old movies, and I'm like, oh, there's a structure that he follows.
Oh yeah, I mean obviously his dialogue, I mean, the one thing that everyone says is that, because his movies are very talky, but there's a lot of dialogue, but his dialogue and the way he shoots the stuff and his characters are so well defined that they are sort of like action scenes. Your heart is racing while people are talking.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like the, I think there's not many writer directors out there that can really pull that off. And I think that's what makes Tarantino so special. So that build up in the dialogue really pays off with that visceral violence.
Yeah.
That he, you know, does towards the end. And that's what I really loved about this one, because it was so, this his latest one, it was so tame. And then really the violence kicks in at the very, very, very fucking end, and it is so isolated. It's only like, it's the violence is of a duration of a song, and then it's over, and that's it. And I just was like, I was waiting for it the entire movie, because like when they're at Spawn Ranch, he starts beating the shit out of the guy. I'm like waiting for him. I'm like, oh, here it is. Here's that little step, that little notch, and then it pulls back.
Well, what I thought, it's interesting how you said that his movies are guided through dialogue and the dialogue provides all the tension. It's like, it's like you said, like an action movie. This one wasn't so much, there was no tension through the dialogue. The tension for me was brought whenever they showed Sharon Tate. I was like, the tension is brought by the expectation that, okay, we know what happens. Like most people know what happened to Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
If you really dig into it and you find out like exactly what happened, it's much more like gruesome, but you know that Sharon Tate got killed by the Manson family, and so you're just like, okay, they're gonna build to that night. They have to. They're putting Manson, Sharon Tate. So every time you see her, you're like, ah, damn, she was really nice, and they're gonna do. She's gonna die, or something's gonna happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then even the Spawn Ranch thing, when he's walking through Spawn Ranch, I thought Brad Pitt was gonna die. I thought he was just
was waiting for characters to die, too. I thought something was going to happen, sort of like that infamous scene from, it's probably in the trailers, but the Inherent Vice moment where he goes to that little suburban community.
Right,
and he's, like, walking through the, like, just where those prostitutes are, and they hit him over the head.
The massage parlor.
Yeah. And so that's what I was waiting for, because he walks down. It's sort of a similar shot, and we're just waiting for that thing to happen. And,
That's an interesting thing, is that Spawn Ranch sequence.
Yeah.
So I've seen the film like twice now, and you had sent me something like, I think because you went the second time with us to see it, but you sent me something from Twitter. I don't know who that was.
Me either.
But it was like someone saying that, like, you know, the Dern character was based off of my great grandfather, and when my family went to go visit, they told like the children to like just look at the ground, like don't make eye contact. And I started thinking about, I'm like, yeah, that is a really scary moment to go visit this like old Hollywood ranch, and it's just overtaken by like hippies, and you don't know whether you're going to get violence, you don't know if you're going to get, you know, watching people do drugs, you don't know what you're going to get. It's just this land that's been overtaken, and I started thinking about, I'm like, it really, like, I don't think the audiences really capture or get the idea that, like, how scary that is to just show up at this like ranch, and
even without the context of knowing what the Manson family, who they were,
exactly,
like even without that, just as a scene on its own,
right? Yeah. Of course, like that would be a really scary thing, just to show up, and you're like greeted by this community that's there. Like, I think that kind of scares me.
Well, one thing that I did think was like really kind of funny is because I feel like he's aware of his formula at this point. Like, he knows what audiences expect out of him, which is just like build up, explosion of violence, and then something. Usually that's the whole movie is that, but sometimes there's scenes that are that, like Inglourious Basterds, when it's the opening scene of that movie, is that's all it is. It's just dialogue that's just making you tense as shit, and then a giant explosion.
Right.
And then, with Spawn Ranch, I was like, okay, so he's going to build, and then he's like, what's the character's name? Bruce Dern's character.
George.
Right? George, yeah. His name's George. Yeah. So he's like, where's George? And he's like, oh, he's in the thing. And then they're all like making up excuses as to why you can't see him. And I'm like, oh, George is going to be dead and he's going to kill them. And then that's going to be the first part of rewriting the history. And then it's building totally towards that. And it's like so overtly like something is going to happen.
Right.
And then it's just like a dialogue exchange where he's just like, I'm fucking blind.
Right.
And
then
it's, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's almost like he knew that that's what everybody wanted, and he just like took that away. And I actually thought it was worked better because of that.
I think the scene also works even better than that as well, because there's another layer to that conversation that I think, I'm not going to say people miss, but something that I sort of got from it, which is, you know, you follow Cliff. First of all, the second time I watched it, when he gets when Cliff picks up the Manson girl, she says she cues him in. Like Cliff has decided to go check on George before she gets in the car. It's not something where he gets to the ranch. He thinks something is fucked up because he's like, George let you stay there? Like, that tension is already there. Something I didn't really catch on the first time. It seems like he gets there and goes, this is weird, and then goes to see George. But the first time, so that whole sequence altogether. But one thing that was interesting to me pulling apart that scene and why that dialogue, because it almost fell flat for me because I was waiting for that explosion. I was waiting for that sense of violence. And then there's just this dialogue scene that is sort of short, sort of a little aloof, strange. It's sort of like a weird scene. It's not something that PTA might write, or somebody, or something that like a Kubrick might write, where like two people seem like they're having two different conversations. It doesn't feel like traditional Tarantino dialogue, that scene. I think what he was trying to do was, because the film ultimately is about the next era of, and the previous era of Hollywood as we're jumping into it. And I think Bruce Dern's character represents old Hollywood. It's blind. It doesn't know who they are. And Cliff went to go check on this person. And it was something that was just, Spahn Ranch was incredibly important to him because that's when he had the most work. That's when his friendship with Rick Dalton was the best. And this is when it was really working. And then he gets to Spahn Ranch and his past denies him. His past tells him, I don't know who you are. Get the fuck out of my house. All I want to do is fuck these Manson girls. Like, I don't know who you are. Get the fuck out of my house. And that's, you know, obviously the through line for Cliff's thing is just like, you know, you're like, you're a good friend. He goes, I try. You know, like, that's his thing is he's of service. He carries the load. And, you know, like, this, his character is definitely someone that carries that. And that's what drives that whole Spahn Ranch scene for me, which is like, it's actually sort of an insecure move for him to go check on this guy.
Yeah.
It's so like the insecurities about the changing world are popping up in this scene. And then we're also going to see that later. But yeah, that Spahn Ranch scene, at first I was like, I lost attention.
Well, the whole movie was, cause I remember I watched it the first time I watched it, I was like, it felt long. I was like, fuck, this is disappointing me. Cause this, it just, I can feel it. I know. I was like, this is going to be plotless. Halfway through it, I was like, there's no plot to this movie. It's going to be his hangout movie that he's constantly talked about he wanted to make. Because he's always been like, there's certain movies that are just hangout movies where you hang out with the characters, you spend time with them, and then the movie just kind of ends. And there's really no plot to speak of, like Dazed and Confused and shit like that. So I was like, damn, okay, this is what we're doing. And then the last act happens, and it's just like, oh, got it. That's what all that was for. That's what all these, like, getting to know these people, it all led to that moment at the end.
That's what's so beautiful about that final, like, Emil Hirsch and Leo scene.
Yeah.
Is like, I felt the same way as you going through the movie. I was like, okay, this is okay. Like, it's fun. There's fun stuff.
It's like slow, though.
The movie, yeah, it is. But the movie just fucking clicked for me when you're watching Leo just sort of sit outside watching the stars, deciding whether he's a tourist or if he's a resident of Los Angeles. And those things are all coming to fruition. Then he turns around and the guy, and then he gets to finally have that moment with Sharon Tate. You know, like, this is the next part of his journey.
Yeah.
And, like, that's when the movie clicked for me. I was like, oh, okay. Like, Sharon Tate's legacy would have been, Hollywood's legacy would have been completely rewritten if Rick Dalton lived next door to Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
And that's where I was like, that's what this fucking movie is about. It's just a fucking fantasy sequence. I mean, the whole thing is a fucking fantasy sequence, but it was like, you had to have a guy like Rick Dalton who was, his career was failing. He had to go do Italian movies. He had to do this whole day where he had to act with this little girl. Cliff had to go to the Manson's, go to Spahn Ranch. He had to pick up that girl. All the right things clicked in place against these two people who were egotistical, just sort of wandering, and all that stuff and saved.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Yeah. I don't think Cliff's that egotistical.
Huh? No, no, no. He's not egotistical. He's... but he's a wanderer.
Sure.
So, I mean, he's going to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. You know, like, so I guess, like, Cliff's more of a wanderer, whereas, like, Rick is just so insecure. So you have this, like, really insecure actor and this wandering stuntman, And those are the two people who rewrite history. And I think that was like the key fucking moment for me. Those are two unexpected people because they're not famous. They're not Brad Pitts, mm-hmm. right? Like Rick Dalton's not a Brad Pitt. Like he's just sort of a middling actor who tried to get out of TV and then failed in movies and now has to go do shitty Italian movies.
It's also about like how you like, especially in Hollywood, you sometimes, if your career isn't blossoming the way you want, you immediately feel like ineffective.
Yeah.
But this film kind of shows like these people who believe that they're ineffective, but they're like, you know, it's moving piece by piece. And I love that aspect of it.
Yeah.
And it is really about like friendship and stuff like that. Even when you're saying like, you know, Cliff saying like, oh, you know, I try at the beginning of the movie. And then when they put him in the ambulance at the end, he's like, I try. Mm. And then he drives off. Rye, what do you think?
I thought it was a great movie. Nothing was boring to me. I related to Leo's character in that he's an alcoholic. And
that scene is brilliant.
Let's just go back to this. All right.
No,
you're talking about the breakdown scene?
The breakdown scene.
Yeah, the breakdown scene.
Fantastic. The fact he's like, I'm sorry to cut you off, Rye. We'll let you talk about your alcoholism in a second. But like I have done that with cigarettes because I was in the process of like trying to quit cigarettes.
What's the breakdown scene? In the trailer?
Yeah, and when he's in the trailer, he's like, fuck you, I'm not smoking cigarettes. Because I'll get stoned and start smoking cigarettes. And then I'll be like, no, I'm killing myself. And da-da-da-da. And then I throw the cigarettes in the trash or throw them down the toilet or something. And then 15 minutes later, I'm walking to the liquor store to buy another pack of cigarettes. I'm sorry. That's just that moment was like, oh, yeah, that's it. That's like, great.
That's addiction, bro.
I know. Yeah. It's amazing.
And I related to him in his career failing, even though I'm a way different scale, just like Vine ending. I was like, oh, yeah, I kind of know what that feels like. Fuck, everything's falling apart.
Right.
And also, my life was falling apart, so I relate to that.
Yeah.
I'm putting it back together.
You had to compete against the Cash Me Outside girl.
Yeah.
Just sort of like the 8-year-old with like the new pumpkin theory puss on acting. Yeah, pumpkin puss. Puss.
what the fuck was I going to say? Oh, I think Margaret Robbie is distractingly pretty. Like, I can't. She doesn't make me horny or anything. I'm just like, oh my God, you're so beautiful.
But Sharon Tate was distractingly pretty as well.
Was she?
Yeah. I mean, she looks, when they do that scene in the theater, which is so fucking good. Like,
it's very sweet.
Yeah, it's a very, like, that scene in the theater kind of, it shows you what, like, why Sharon's in this movie. Like, to provide this, like, warm, like, glow for this movie. Like, like a heart to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me but also it makes you sad because you're like, fuck, she seemed like such a nice person that just like wanted to help people and just and liked being in movies to get a reaction out of an audience, not for any like narcissistic thing. She just enjoys making an audience like happy.
Exactly. Yeah, and, that's good. I didn't catch that. That's I did because going up against like Rick Dalton. Yeah, going up against Rick Dalton. Rick's so concerned about his appearance to the other actors and directors.
But Sharon's the opposite of that. Right, she's not taken by the... Because, I mean, Sharon Tate at that time wasn't a huge movie star at all. She was about like to be, maybe.
Two or three movies,
Yeah, but she was, you know, she was dating or married to Roman Polanski. And, you know, and it was unfortunate that, like, she wasn't that huge movie star. But that's what's so great about that scene is that you're seeing the opposite of Rick, somebody that's like doesn't care about that stuff and really just cares about making
people happy.
Yeah, making the audience like happy and enjoy and but I mean Sharon Tate in that scene, Sharon Tate, they show the actual movie and I'm just like, holy fuck, dude. She looks just like Sharon Tate.
I didn't think she did at all.
Really?
I thought it was distracting. I was like, who the fuck is that?
Really?
You know what's funny is so my girlfriend Cheyenne didn't know anything about the Manson murders. Or she was like, who the fuck is Sharon Tate? Why am I following this person? She didn't know. So when she goes to the box office and she's like, she's trying to convince them that she's Sharon Tate. And then she goes inside and they watch the movie with Sharon Tate. My girlfriend thought she was an imposter. She thought like this was a plot point that Sharon was lying. About who she was. So I could imagine that it's distracting.
I actually didn't know Sharon Tate. I knew she got involved with the Mansons, but
That's the thing. That's what I love about this is so many people go, Sharon Tate, Manson murders. That's it. They don't go, mm-hmm. Sharon Tate was in, Wrecking Crew. Yeah, right. And that's what I loved about it. It's just showing you her as a person, not as a statistic.
But yeah.
That's part of these murders.
Right. I was going to say, I thought she was involved in the Manson murders, maybe in that she got involved in the cult.
No.
Not
at all?
So
at the very end, she said through the sound box, which sounded exactly like the woman from The Shining, hey, you want to come in?
Oh, Shelley Duvall? Oh.
Yeah, sounded fucking exactly like her.
Wow. You want some sandwiches, hon? I'll make you some sandwiches.
Jesus Christ.
I could see that. It was
Oh, my God, that's great.
There was a lady in the theater like next to us who was like, oh, no. It was creepy. It was like something was going to happen.
Round
there.
Two.
Oh, yeah.
And then she says through the box, like, want to come in for some drinks with my other friend? I was like, all right, is this... Then I was trying to see who the other friend was. I was like, is that Charles Manson?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Is Rick Dalton going to get killed by the Mansons because she's part of it?
Yeah.
So who was that other friend in the driveway?
That was Jay Sebring.
So they had... Her connection to the Mansons...
No, wait. Who's Jay Sebring?
Jay Sebring was the friend who was with Sharon in the house when she was killed. And he was killed. The thing that... Okay, so this movie... Apparently, it's super beneficial to know what happened. Like, what actually happened. Like, without that... Yeah, I can actually kind of see how it would be extremely confusing.
I was only confused at the end.
Yeah.
Well, you were waiting for something else.
I knew she was killed, but I thought maybe she got involved in the cult.
Oh, gotcha. Well, okay. So basically, just a really quick run through about like what actually happened. Charles Manson was a crazy person that went to jail a whole bunch, and then he wanted to be a musician, and he was he met what was his name? Dennis Wilson. Dennis Wilson and. What's the other guy's name?
Well, the two guys he was recording music with owned the Polanski house. So they were So the Polanskis, Sharon Tate, were renting the house or had purchased the house from these two people that Charles Manson used to record with. Previous to the murders, Charles Manson had thought that Helter Skelter from the Beatles had... spoken to him. Like, they thought that Beatles was telling him to... So, was speaking to him directly. So, he started a bunch... He wanted to start a race war.
Yeah. Nice.
So, he actually went up to the house to kill...
Well, that's the thing. He went up to the house to... He knew that Terry Melcher and... they didn't live there anymore.
Yeah,
he knew that. Because he did go to the house. That scene in the movie where Charlie Manson goes and he's like, hey, is Terry Melcher here? I'm here to see Dennis Wilson or something. And they're like, no, that actually happened. He did see Sharon Tate there. And whether he knew who she was, no one knows that. But when he he tells his followers, or three of them, like, go to Terry's house and completely destroy and kill anything in that house. Like, kill anybody and make it... like a brutal, brutal murder. Like, make it witchy. That's what he said. Make it look really witchy.
Was he supposed to kill everyone in that cul-de-sac?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I know he went to the house, but maybe I read or misread something, but they were supposed to hit every house in that cul-de-sac.
They were, because he wanted, Charlie Manson wanted for them to also rob them after they killed them.
Got it.
So he said, if you don't get a lot of money from them, then go to each house until you get a bunch of money.
Got it.
But they killed, so basically what happened was they all go to the house and they all just kill everybody inside. And like four people were in that house. Everybody that you see in the ending of the movie, because Kurt Russell does this narration that's like, Jay Sebring like smoked a fat joint and all these, and Abigail Folger is another person.
Yeah.
So all these people were in the house, and what happened was they all killed them, brutally killed them. Like,
there was a fifth person, and they were staying out in this guest house.
But he wasn't killed, I don't think.
He wasn't killed, but that's, because when the cops showed up, he had no idea that shit was going on.
Right? Yeah, and then there was some random, like, delivery guy or something that got killed, and he got shot in his car by Tex Watson. But, so,
I like my version better, when I thought maybe she got involved, because about feet, since I thought she was, like, getting, becoming evil, maybe.
Right.
When you first see Margot Robbie's feet, they're clean. And I know everyone's obsessed with Tarantino and his supposed foot fetish.
It's distracting in this movie.
You were trying to...
Genuinely, I was like, dude, holy... the second time it happened, when she puts her feet on the window...
Well, she does it with some force. Yeah, she does it on purpose.
Everybody laughed.
So you first see Margot Robbie's feet. They're clean.
Yeah.
Then when she's in the movie theater, they're dirty. And I thought, oh, she's becoming a narcissist because she's watching herself in the movie screen. Now her feet are dirty. She's getting, she's
corrupted.
Corrupted, yeah.
Yeah.
That's,
and then,
that is
that's a great
wow.
And right, the hippie girl in the car, her feet are dirty. Like they're innocent. They have bare feet. Innocent young girls, but they're getting dirty.
Mm-hmm.
That was my thought, and the movie's better that way. So,
but that's a great point, because like I felt like that at certain points during the film, because you're like, our brains are trying to like sort of like
figure out what's going on,
categorize
in the movie.
It. You know, yeah. I mean, even like what we're saying now, we're going like, is it like Pulp? Is it like Jackie? Is it like what? Yeah. Like we're trying to get it into this like little box to sort of understand the filmmaker and the three act structure, but like. This is the dude who like invented his own genre. The people refer to, oh, you're going to Tarantino your movie. Like he's his own little genre.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's.
Well, actually, I don't want to go into that, but yeah. So basically what happened was Sharon Tate was in the wrong place at the wrong time. She wasn't, they didn't know. I mean, like he knew that some person like he said, cause Tex Watson, who was one of the guys that killed Sharon Tate, and all her friends, he was like, who lives in that house now? And he's like, I don't know, some movie stars or something. So he didn't even know. He just wanted to kill. He wanted to strike like the wealthy and the famous. And that was his plan, was to, because that house meant something to him because he was backstabbed by Terry Melcher. Because Terry Melcher was like, hey, I'm going to get you a record contract. And then nothing happened. And Dennis Wilson, same thing. He's like, oh, I'm going to get you. And then nothing happened. Right. So
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm about to insult the late great Luke Perry.
Okay.
Possibly insult. Was he directed to act super flat and poorly in his scene?
Maybe. Well, okay, so that whole show is based off an actual show. It's called Lancer. That was made in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen it, but he played as an actual character in the show.
Yeah.
So maybe in the show, he's as fucking flat as like 2-day-old soda, but I don't fucking know. Like, right. Like I kind of thought the same thing too, but I also don't know Luke Perry's acting that well. I haven't seen him in that much.
I don't think he's all that great, but I don't know. I saw him in 90210 when I was like a little tiny kid.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Maybe it was to show how good Rick is.
That's what I thought, maybe.
Because it's like Rick kills it in that scene, and you're really paying all attention to him.
Right.
So it makes you feel like,
yeah.
Can we talk about for a second that when he start his Leo's faces after he fucks up the lines?
Yeah.
When he's like starting to overact and compensate are fucking hilarious.
So
he's
good.
Like,
yeah.
He's like,
yeah.
Maybe he already has. Like. Yeah. Like, it's just so, it's like he loses confidence in himself.
Yeah.
So he's like, fuck, now I got to do 20 times what I was doing before. And that whole scene is one take. That whole part where they're, as soon as they like sit down and start circling around, doing that like Tarantino circle around, it's so fucking good how he's like showing you, okay, this is obviously the TV show but you get sucked into that when you're watching, at least I did, when they're showing the show that he's filming.
Right.
And they're just showing it as a show. They're showing it as like its own little movie. And then it's just like, fuck. What was the line? And then you just hear him off screen. It's just like so
back to one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like kind of giving the audience a chance to sort of like see it from the filmmaker's point of view. Because then they reset and it kind of goes back around.
Tarantino's giving you his eye in that scene.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
You're not you're just hearing the director in the background.
Yeah.
It doesn't cut back to the director or anything like that. Like he's really giving you the eye and the actor arguing with the director. So you're sort of sitting in the director's chair at that moment and sort of just watching the performance, which is you don't usually get out of a movie. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's supposed to be that distance between. Well, I guess there's supposed to be more immersion. Tarantino's giving you that distance to be able to critique Rick as an actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it makes it more engaging for the audience.
Right.
You know, you're not just sitting there watching Bounty Law. You know what I
right.
mean?
Yeah.
You're actually like behind the scenes. So he does like a couple different things. Like one thing I really wanted to talk about is the soundtrack.
Oh yeah,
that's awesome.
The soundtrack is like, so I was just listening to like whatever someone threw together on Spotify, mm-hmm. and then the official soundtrack came out, and I was actually driving through Hollywood, just driving home, and I didn't realize they baked in all the advertisements into the soundtrack. So I'm like driving there through Hollywood, and I just hear the weather in Los Angeles today is blah blah blah, and then it cuts to like a root beer float ad, and I was like, what the fuck is this? This is amazing. And then the first song just like kicks off, and it's like the Los Bravos. It was like you were just transported. Really cool. And then when I saw the film the second time, I started to pay attention to where the advertisements like were. And the first time you see like Rick noticing his next door neighbor Polanski, he's like, "That's Polanski!" Like, and he talks about like, "That's the in crowd. I want to be with that crowd." Right. Yeah. You hear this advertisement for a men's cologne called Numero Uno, and it's Numero Uno cologne. There are only four masculine smells, and it's like just this like zoom on Sharon Tate and Polanski, and he's just like admiring them from afar. And it's like a really cool use of advertisement because it becomes like not only what the characters are hearing in their car, but it becomes sort of like sound design score at that point.
Yeah.
And he does it a couple times in the movie.
He does a really great thing where he sort of gets a little meta with it. Like, people should be paying attention. Like, I know that they're funny bits to see, like, old stuff recreated and shit like that. It's funny. But he does this bit, like, right before everything's set off and Brad Pitt has, like, Cliff smokes the acid cigarette.
Yeah.
There is a point in the movie on one of the advertisements or when it cuts over to the TV where the guy goes, "Now for what you came for."
Yep, I picked that up. I picked that up the second time. I was like, fuck. Okay. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, cool. You, like, the advertising and everything is talking to you as an audience. Like, that's how Quentin is cueing you and being like, hey, like, there's a little nods to the audience. They're much more than just homage. That's how he's communicating with you, and he's having a lot of fun with it. And that's the other thing. Like, I've seen a bunch of his... Obviously, I've seen all of his movies. We've seen all of his movies. I feel like he was just having a lot of fucking fun doing this movie, as much as it's not like... It's one of those movies... like, his other movies are obviously... it feels like he's having fun. This one, I just feel like he was just so laid back and just so like, you know what? Fuck it. I'll just superimpose Leo... in The Great Escape. Like, right. I'll just, you know, like, fuck it. Like, it doesn't mean anything at the end of the day. It only means anything to Rick that they shot this movie and then cut him out and reshot the movie. And he's now hiding behind that. Like, those type of insecurities and stuff. Like, I don't know. This just, but that just seems like, it just felt like a lot more. He was just having a lot of fun. And it was felt more laid back. And that's why the movie feels so laid back.
Well, that's the thing, too, because I was like, on first watch, like I said, I didn't really get what he was going for. And then the ending happens. I'm like, okay. And then the second time I watched it, I remember I was just like, this movie is literally shooting 1969 Hollywood into my arm. Like, with every fucking thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before all the shots of the beer and the food cans and all the different stuff on the marquee and all this shit, all the cars, all of it. I was like, okay, that's fine, but like, what's the story? And then when I realized, I mean, not the story, the plot. I was like, what's going on? What's going to happen? And then I was like, okay, he wants me to soak this shit in. So I'm going to soak it in. And I fucking loved everything about the set design, about the costumes, about the cars, about the soundtrack, about everything.
The cars rumble like a motherfucker.
Yeah, and just like everybody's smoking, just like every scene, Cliff's in, he's casual, just smoking.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's really just saying, I mean, clearly Quentin Tarantino has a huge hard-on for for that age of Hollywood. Because he's throwing in references that are just like, even for somebody who loves movies, you're like, wait, what? Yeah. What is this?
Right, right.
You know, it's like, what is this? Even Lancer, like, which was an actual show. Mm-hmm. It's like, what's Lancer?
Right.
And it's like, but he just, you can tell he has, like you said, he has such a, I would actually, when you said about him being laid back, I actually think he put a lot of fucking effort into this. Because,
I'm not to say it's not effort. I'm just saying that the effort was there, but I also feel like his heart rate was lower than on other projects.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, that's, I mean, just to kind of like build off of that, like the idea, like it opens with that like Al Pacino scene. He plays like Schwartz or something that.
Schwartz.
Yeah. And he's telling him, he's like, I queued up some 35 millimeter film. And it's like, I'm sitting there in the audience just going like, does that mean anything to anybody sitting here? Because like, essentially he's telling this to this actor. He's like, I just watched your reel.
Yeah.
I watched your reel, and to everyone in LA that's like, oh, I sent you a YouTube link.
Yeah.
Check out my reel. And it's like, but at the time he's like, no, I took the time, I queued it up, I got my wife here, we're having some drinks, watching your stuff.
He goes through his little process where he grabs his wife goes to bed, he pours himself a cognac and he gets himself a cigar.
Right. And it's like there's
that's
like
a ritual. It's like this ritual that this person has.
And I'm sitting there wondering, like, is this just going over the audience's head, or is it like, how is it registering with them? Because like, there was a real like, you know, that old Hollywood, even at the 1969, like there's still like that tenderness to like caring about like taking the time to queue up some film and watch it. You know what I mean? And we, you know, we come from like what, Vine, where it's like 6 seconds. You're thinking about like, it's 6 seconds to be funny, but the idea to like someone taking the time to watch your work is so interesting. And it's a weird way. It's also like a really great way, I think, to start the film with that character.
That going, tenderness,
just going like, look, I watched your stuff.
But it's also that conversation leads to him just saying like, you're washed up now.
Exactly.
Which is so funny because it's such a bait and switch. He's like, he's so tender and he's like, oh, I love all the shooting, all of that stuff. Yeah. And then he's just like, look, down goes you. He's talking about him being becoming the enemy instead of the leading guy. He's like, down goes you, down goes your career as a leading man.
He's getting the shit kicked out of him all the time.
Yeah.
But that's so smart. That's a real thing.
Yeah.
You know, like watching your favorite characters. If we got watched Brad Pitt get the shit kicked out of him all the time, he wouldn't be as famous as he is. Like,
and Ken, you do or do not think the Bruce Lee scene was her daydream.
Okay, so this is, I actually was going to bring this up next because this is my favorite sequence in the movie.
Mm-hmm. The Bruce Lee scene?
The whole flashback.
Sure.
So that includes him getting onto the roof, seeing Manson. Well, he sees Manson after the flashback. So he gets on the roof, he has his cigarette, and this is all queued up by a conversation that really goes, I feel like, goes over people's head, because what Leo is saying is like, oh yeah, the key on this project worked with Randy, the gaffer, da da da, the circuit. Like, they're just words to most people, and that's why. And I think at that moment, it's the moment where Cliff sits there and goes, is Rick full of shit? Is he trying to abandon me?
Mm.
And that's when he recollects that moment. He's trying to work through it. That's why the punchline at the end of the whole thing is like, oh, yeah, no, I deserve that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Like, he's at the end of that, he's going, yeah, Rick's right. He's not trying to leave me. I was an asshole that day.
But do you think that that act, that whole thing with Bruce Lee happened in the, I mean, like, in the facts of the actual, like, what happens in the movie? Or do you think that that's a daydream in his head? Like, he's, like, almost like Cliff, that's his recollection of the events. And he put himself, like, oh, I kicked Bruce Lee's ass.
I think it's fair to say, only because as I'll say this, there's a moment where in the middle of the fight, everyone disappears.
Yeah.
In the background. So there's a bunch of people hanging out. And then as soon as the throw to the car happens, almost everyone's gone. And now it's just them two. So if there is any evidence of it being just mainly his perspective or his memory or his recollection of the event, then that would be it. I do think all of that stuff happened. But I don't think I don't think it's a daydream. I don't think he was thinking about kicking Bruce Lee's ass or thinking about it in that way.
Because that whole scene, that's just showing why he's not allowed on, like why he has problems with the Green Hornet guy. And like you said, like why,
why he can't. So you had Randy who ran all the stuntmen, him and his wife.
Yeah.
Right. So, Zoe Bell's character, right?
Yeah.
So Zoe Bell's character. I think like he's just trying to figure out whether Rick is sort of leaving him, and it could be very much his own version and recollection of those events that occurred.
I think it actually happened too. I think that's what happened, and it's just to show like how like Cliff is this. God damn it! I fucking love Cliff's character so much. I like him more than Rick.
Because
Cliff's just like such a good friend. And like, yeah. and but he's also that kind of guy that would beat the shit out of you. And once you're done getting the shit kicked out of you, you're like, oh yeah, I get it. And I'm not mad about the fact that the shit was just beat out of me by this guy. Because he's just so like...
He's a man's man.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's also like very zen in that he'll buy like an acid cigarette.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I
yeah.
mean? Like,
you can tell Rick is scared of him in the first scene that they're together. Because they're... What does he got? He's like, let me get my glasses back. And oh, yeah, they have like, that little interaction where he goes like this. But you can see in Leo's face that he's like, yeah. no, this guy can kick the fucking shit out of me. Right. So like yeah. he's cueing these little things in there early yeah. on, and then it builds. And then,
yeah,
yeah I mean, you're not going to believe that a man really just like threw a giant can of dog food at the speed of light at someone's face.
Yeah.
like unless you see everything that Cliff does. So you need that scene to be like, you know, oh, okay, no, like, this guy is a fucking, like, he's a war vet, right?
Yeah.
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 He's just, I mean, he also just has, like, a great, like, set of values, too. Mm-hmm. He going back to the Spahn Ranch thing where the guy, you know, puts a knife in his tire. Yeah. And he goes, this is my boss's car. You're going to change it. And it's like, that's such a great character moment for him to just tell someone, like, change the tire. And he, like, gets it out of the trunk and just throws it down on the ground. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Well, as much as I like Cliff's character too, I'm kind of like, I'm wondering like, why did he put in the detail about him possibly killing his wife?
Yeah, I don't know.
I thought of a few reasons.
Go for it.
The first one was that it's literally it's placing you in the shoes of Rick, where you have to decide, do you trust Cliff based off of his likability as a character? Or do you not trust? Like, do you like Cliff based off that information? Or do you not like Cliff based
off
that information?
I totally think that works for it, yeah.
I think that's why, and it's like testing the audience in a way.
I think it's a version of Quentin's, like, when you hear rumors around Hollywood.
Yeah.
Because you don't see the wife die. You just see the moment. And we're led to believe that he's so pissed off at her. She's nagging away about how shitty the boat is, how shitty this person is. And then the harpoon's pointed at her. Like, he's literally directing you to take that information in and think that, like, he killed his wife.
Yeah.
I think it's a piece of Quentin Hollywood folklore that's in there. I think it's just another slice of what Hollywood is like. It's kind of like the story that you hear about, like, I heard a story a couple years back that the only reason why they don't put Robert Rodriguez's name or he couldn't do as many movies is because there was an on-set incident that he pulled a shotgun out on another character because he was flirting with Rose McGowan, who they were dating or married at the time. So he was very protective of her. This is a Hollywood myth. I don't know if that fucking happened or not. That's just a rumor, you know? But that's about a prolific director that worked with Quentin. Mm. And then the rumor continues on and goes, oh, well, he did that. And that's the reason why he can't get insurance on his projects. And he has to work with two directors now. Mm. All of his movies now, he has to work with two directors because they can't get insurance on Robert Rodriguez because he's fucking crazy.
So you think it's just like a reflection of that?
I think it's a reflection of how rumors sort of maneuver around Hollywood, you know, because nobody knows.
Yeah.
Because what Randy says and what he thinks his wife, because she goes, she believes it, I believe it.
Yeah.
You know, like that's sort of where it lies, and it's just the opinion of it. And I think that happens all the time on sets where you hear rumors about X, Y, and Z, this person, and then you start... I mean, I'm not going to give zero specifics, but these are the type of conversations that happen in writers' rooms where people start talking about who was working on what set. And when you start hiring people, you start talking about these people because that's part of the process. Who do you want on your set? Mm. Who do you want part of this project? So the stuff, whether it's true or not, is going to resurface, and people are going to talk to you behind closed doors.
Yeah.
So that's a reflection of that part of Hollywood that happens just in the insular, like, on the set kind of shit. So that's what I pulled more from it. It was just like Quentin created his own little folklore that existed in this movie.
I thought he put it in because killing women is funny.
That could be, yeah, I think he hit the nail on the head.
Nailed it.
Quentin Tarantino hates women. Yeah. I think he just wanted to express that.
Yeah. I have actually seen like a lot of criticism of this is that this is, it uses violence against women as a butt of a joke.
Yeah,
I saw that. The main way that it does that is the ending, which, I mean, I just kind of want to talk about the ending because it's like...
It's incredible. I can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
I listen to the song all day now, like the song from Vanilla Fudge. It's, God damn it.
You just keep me hanging on.
You keep me hanging on from Vanilla Fudge. It's not on the soundtrack, but you can find it on like Apple Music and just add it to it. But
I love the part when Cliff is walking down the hill and then the song, the car pulls up with the Manson family in it. Yeah. And just that song that's playing is fucking perfect, and it plays throughout the whole part when Rick's just like fucking private road, and then he's just like goes on solo.
Margarita. I love that he's like making the loud like margarita, and he's like shaking it, and then he just hears like the muffler, and he's just like, "It's 3 a.m.
He's too drunk for this. He's way too drunk. Yeah, exactly. It's like it's one of those moves that he probably would have just called the cops, or just let it be. And if he wasn't as blitzed as he was.
Yeah. And if you think about it, like that's like that moment where he's like just screaming at them and like making them kind of cry and tear up.
Like, Texas crying.
That's essentially like the twist right there is like Rick Dalton goes and yells at the Manson kids and like and then pisses them off. Like that's essentially the twist of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, well, because that's how the rest of the twist happens.
I thought about that. I'm like, what is this big? Is there going to be a big twist? And I'm like, no, that's it right there. That's that moment. It's like, it's really funny.
Yeah. It's him and his most insecure and drunk. And that's, you know, like he's now accepted his fate as a failed, like the fact that he took the spaghetti Westerns is an acceptance of his failed career.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the conversation with Cliff is like, I'm going to have to downsize. I can't afford you anymore. And like, this is all an acceptance of fucked up. Like it's all over.
Yeah.
And, like all of that, all of the 2 hours before up until the Randy narration towards the end is literally building up to him acting like a complete asshole in that cold set, like in that.
And his hatred of hippies, hatred of hippies really just like,
but he doesn't know that they're hippies before he walks out. He's just drunk and sad.
You know, he says like, you fucking hippies came here to smoke pot, didn't you? On our private lot. Well, fix your fucking muffler next time. And it's just like, I love that scene. Cause I'm like, oh fuck. Cause when that happens. So before the movie even happened, I was like, okay, Tarantino's not going to show Sharon Tate die. There's no way he can do that with it. Cause like, as the movie goes on, you realize this is a comedy. This is a full blood. Yeah. This is Tarantino's like comedy movie.
It's his Big Lebowski.
Yeah, it is. And it's just like, because it's so funny and it's pretty lighthearted up until Spawn Ranch and it just gets really tense. But so I was like, there's no fucking way he is going to show Sharon Tate, even in danger. He can't do that because it wouldn't fit with the tone of this movie.
No.
So I was like, but what else is that? Like literally what else can you do? My original thought, all the events were going to happen, but Rick and Cliff were somehow going to like save them.
Yeah, that's what that was my take on that as well. When they came up, so that's exactly what I thought was going to happen. That they were going to make it up to the Polanski's house, Tate's house, and then, but I didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah, I didn't, but that's the thing. Once we're in that, once Rick is out yelling at them and he's like cocking the gun, I was like, fuck. Now we're in the part of Tarantino movies where shit can just happen.
Yeah.
Like things can just now fucking Leo can die. Fucking everybody can just die. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I thought it was like so great that they just back up the Manson family. They back up and then they're just all like, wait, that was fucking Jake Cahill that like yelled. Exactly. And then it becomes like, oh, this fictional character is now like the people who the real life people are aware of this fictional character. So it's like, oh, wait. And that's when it clicked in my head. I was like, what's going to happen. Probably not, but I think that's what's going to happen. And then when they're all just like, when Susan Atkins in the back is just like, we got to fucking kill those.
Sure. Her small, like, performance in the back of that car is fucking brilliant.
Yeah, it's great.
Like, it's so good. She's like, we're going to go up there and fucking kill them. Yeah, they taught us how to murder. Yeah. We're going to kill the people who taught us how to murder. And it's like,
Same with Tex Watson. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. But same with the other actors in the car too.
Oh no, they're all the. I mean, everyone he picked was incredible. Yeah. Except for I guess Rye's opinion of
dude.
Poor guy. But no, they were all incredible. Like Tex's whole thing. That scene plays so funny because it's like, oh, these people are like these Manson kids. We make them out to be like these very strange and powerful and evil Satanist cult figures. Yeah. But really, they're just as consumed with pop culture as we are. Like he had a lunchbox with Rick's face on it.
Yeah.
You know, like,
well, that's what's so great, too, is because when they finally do, when they make the choice, we're going to fucking kill going to that house
right.
instead of that house. When they decide to do that, and then that whole sequence happens, which is fucking great. When Cliff's just, he's just like, don't shoot me. He's like waving his hand, and he's high on acid, mm-hmm. and he's just like, I am doing the best I can under the circumstances. Yeah. Like, it's mm-hmm. so fucking good. And then when he like kicks open the door, and he's just like talking to all of them, like very clearly fucked up. And then they all just start getting brutally murdered, mm-hmm. like one after the other. And Tex was like, he's like crying and shaking as he's holding the gun. And I'm like, holy fuck. As soon as they start killing all of them, I'm like, this is fucking great. They're taking the piss and they're taking that power away.
Yeah, from those.
From the killers.
From like the event and then,
Yeah, they're like fully saying fuck you to these people right. and just taking all the power away. And that's why, like, I just think it's so fucking great that that he's able to get you to literally cheer for.
Oh, well, the theater was hysterical,
dude!
Like,
it's
just
crazy how huge of applause and just like laughs and all that shit that come from something that's horribly violent. But the only reason why, to me, the reason why that's such a huge like payoff is if you know Susan Atkins was the one that killed Sharon Tate in the most brutal way. Tex Watson and all these people, they killed these people in the worst
way. They wrote pig and blood.
Yeah.
Like, on the thing. Like, it was a brutal, insane fucking murder.
That,
yeah.
That's why I thought that, like, Susan got the worst of it. Like, that her character, yeah. like, she gets the worst of it. She gets, like, mauled by the dog and then, like, can thrown at her fucking face.
That can hit is, like, that's my favorite. One of my favorite moments for me.
I want to watch the behind the scenes.
Yeah.
I'm just.
Because
like,
when that can hits her face,
yeah.
I was like, I'm so in. Because, you know, you get Brandy the dog, the true MVP of the movie,
yeah.
by the way. But you get Brandy the dog to, like, go up and bite Tex Nuts. And that's funny. It's very all Looney Tunes yeah. fucking, like, you know. But it's when Brad turns just very calmly and just chucks that fucking dog food at her face and it hits. And I'm just like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
There it is. And then she gets the worst of it with Brandy, too.
Yeah.
Like, Brandy's, like, dragging her.
Mauling Susan. Because yeah. Susan, like I said, she was one of the worst ones in that family. In that trio of people that killed, when they were killing Sharon Tate, she was, in my opinion, like, the most evil. So I was like, it's so funny how they reserve all the beating for her.
I just want to, like, go back to a moment where it could seem like the movie is sort of boring.
Yeah.
And then go to back to this end scene here, because a lot of the tension has to do with something very, very early on that's really boring to most audiences, which is when he's feeding his dog and that process.
Yeah.
Quentin spends so much time as he's making macaroni and cheese and pouring the dog food and talking to Brandy, having that communication and all that other stuff. And literally the fact that he's high out of in space, mm-hmm. but like, we're, you know, Brandy is reacting to the people coming up the door. And remember then the line of dialogue, he goes, don't whine because I'll throw this food out.
Yeah.
Well, like, we're actually, like, rooting for Brandy to, like, get Cliff to get his shit to fucking together. Because, there's about to be some crazy shit to go down. Like, Quentin did a brilliant job of taking something very mundane and building a beautifully tense scene before they actually walk into the house with Brandy's reactions. And like the amount of care and attention that was put into that, you're going like, why am I watching this? And then you're like, no, Brandy, bark more. I know you won't get your food, but come on. It's like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, most people have to blow up cars on a fucking highway or do this crazy shit where somebody's like, every action director or thriller director has to go above and beyond, but really Quentin
built a response.
To get a response out of an audience. And Quentin doesn't need to do that shit. He's just like, you know, the dog's hungry and he's high.
You go.
I was gonna say, it almost feels like psychological at that point, because you've seen so many like inserts of like dog food. And you're watching it like fall from the can into the thing, and you watch it happen again, and it's on the shelf. Like, he's kind of like, sort of just like playing with the audience, like toying you. Like, why are you showing me this dog food?
Yeah, yeah. And wait, what were you gonna say, Ray?
Is there a reason why Brad Pitt was on acid? Is that just to be fun?
I think that's to. I honestly think it's to like make it to where they are like more of a
demons.
Threat to him. Yeah, I think it's that that there would be more of a threat, which is why he's so fucking brutally violent towards these people. Like, it kind of, you know, like, if he that's wasn't true, on acid, yeah. I don't feel like that, the brutality of how...
It would have happened more like the Bruce Lee scene. It would have been more of a fight. And, because he could, he could probably take two girls and Tex, who's, like, crying as he's holding a gun. Like, all he had to do is take the gun and then point it at them. And then that would have been the end of it. Call the cops. We're going. You know, like, that scene wouldn't have occurred unless she was just completely high on acid.
Yeah. But I just think it's so fucking, like... down to little shit, like that line that Tex says about, like, I'm the devil and I'm here to do the devil's business. That's something he actually said in the house. And the fact that he's just like, he says that line and he's just like, nah, I was dumber than that. Like, he's just taking the piss out of all of it. He's taking the piss out of all of it. And it's so fucking great. And then when it's like Susan Atkins bursts through the fucking window, it's legitimately just turns into like a fucking, like you said, Looney Tunes.
Oh yeah, the shot where she, like, because she falls down and then Rick goes, "What the fuck?" Yeah. Right? And then the shot is right in front of her. I think it crosses over the pool as she falls into the pool, but she literally pops into frame, has her hands up, and is like, you know, and just like freaking out. She jumps in the pool, and then you get that moment where Rick is sort of like walking towards her, not knowing what the fuck's going on. And then she like sits up, starts shooting the gun again, and then that brilliant moment where you see just right under the table the fucking flamethrower.
Yeah.
You're just like, where is he fucking going? Yeah. And then that, he's like, is there any way to turn this down? Yeah. And he's like, it's a flamethrower.
Yeah.
It's too hot.
It's too hot. If we're to turn it down. But yeah, dude, that flamethrower, like, you talk about like moments with an audience that just fucking hits so hard. And that's just like a mat, like, fucking such a great callback and just so, like, rewarding for everybody.
I saw it at 310 at Universal City.
Yeah.
And there was no cheering, barely any laughing.
Really?
Really?
Oh, man.
No, because it wasn't a full theater.
See, that's interesting, too, because you might want to... It might be the type of movie that you watch with a big, loud audience. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because I saw it, like, twice, and one audience was, like, kind of loud. They were into it, laughing. Mm. But then there's one audience that was just, like you were saying, when you first...
The Saturday night
you
one?
You see the shot of him, like... You see the like a little like bit of the flamethrower from under the table, and the audience like it clicked for them.
Oh, yeah. they were like clapping, cheering, like
they like lit up. Like, oh my god, it's a flame! And like you hadn't even seen the full shot of what he was holding.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, and that like sort of solidifies the idea that like, yeah, this is Tarantino's comedy, even when he's at the end of the movie where he's just like, yeah, I got a flamethrower in the shed.
Yeah, like, right. Nonchalant about it.
Yeah, like, I burnt one of them up to a crisp. And then he's like, they died afterward. Like, that's not like, that's how you know that like, that this is just a comedy. Yeah,
it really, I think that not your full enjoyment of the movie, but it is it's hampered a bit if you don't fuck with that ending, I think. Because that ending is when you really think about it, it's kind of out of place for the rest of the movie, in a way. Like, with what the movie's going for, like, it's very mature. It's, like, the most mature thing he's done, Tarantino, since Jackie Brown. And you're just like, oh, this is... I kind of like that. Like, it's... If you're watching it without any knowledge of the Manson murders or anything like that, or any of this shit, then it just like explodes once again. And I think that if you don't like the ending, then it almost can ruin it for you. But I mean, like, I'm saying that somebody who fucking loved the ending. And on first viewing, I was like, the ending is what made the rest of the movie better.
Right.
But I could see how the ending could actually make it worse for people that are just like, wait, what? Why is he killing these hippies? Like,
oh,
what,
yeah. You know what I mean, it's like, I mean, the film's very contingent and is loaded in that way that you need to know about Sharon Tate and the Manson murders. And
otherwise, you're like, why are we following this lady to the movie theater? Why are we showing her at a Playboy band? Why are we? It's like a lot of why are we doing this?
You don't even know who Charlie Manson is because they don't signify. They don't tell him who he is. He just walks up. You have to know who he is. You have to know what's going on in the movie before you watch the movie.
Yeah. I mean, this is it's got a lot going on. I mean, there are moments where he's showing you the movie posters that Rick starred in, like the Italian movies, and getting laughs out of just a shot of a movie poster.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's such an interesting choice. Too, it's like, our audience, like, are they on board with that? Like, I'm always kind of like wondering, you know, because like the audience that we saw it with, they like liked it a lot.
Yeah,
you know, they were with it. But I could see, like, I mean, how come there, like, was there just not a lot of people in the theater when you
Yeah, there just wasn't a lot.
Oh, okay.
Go catch it at the New Beverly, Tarantino's Theater, because I don't know if you'll catch the same crowd from, like, opening weekend, because that's, like, that's going to be Tarantino, you know, ride or dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think the crowd that you might find some of that, like, explosive, sort of like if you were to go to a Rocky Horror, or a picture show or something like that, or, like, a room...
Yeah.
Screening or something like that, right, where you're going to get the audience engagement. You probably need to go to like a to the New Bev.
Yeah, or the Dome. The Dome's great. ArcLight. That's where I saw it the third time. But
did you see it 70?
I saw it in 70. Yeah,
which, how
but
is
they
it?
They didn't film it in 70 millimeters.
No, it's
so
35.
They just blew it up to 70.
Yeah, you can do that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't
it's
see.
It's probably
any...
just a different black box. Like they just covered up because it's not going to look as wide.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't. When I was watching it, I was like, "Oh, I forgot that I'm watching this in 70 in quotes, like 70 millimeter."
It's just
like,
a 70 print. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, no, like, I don't know, but after the ending, all the violence and just the fucking the aftermath, it was just like they're talking to the cops. It's just like, yeah, just bust in here.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The guy was like, I'm here to do some devil shit. I don't know. Like, right. It was just like, he continually keeps taking the piss out of this. And then that great scene where he's just like, Cliff, even when he's been stabbed, he's like, no, don't come with me to the hospital. Just, you know, hang out with Francesca and go make sure my dog's okay. And then like, he just, it's just like, it's one of those like character moments that, like you said, where the whole movie is really about these two guys. Because when you see the poster or any trailers, you're like, oh, this is like an ensemble movie. With all
it's
these actors,
with
Al Pacino, with Margot Robbie, with everybody who's in this, and then you're like, oh, this is a very small story.
Well, that's why it's like the Big Lebowski in that way. It's like you have all these actors and all these people just coming in and out of stuff, and sometimes you only hang out with them for a scene. Sometimes they might come back for a moment later. You know, there's that great scene where the dude walks in on the artist who plays her. She like swings in.
Oh, Julianne Moore.
Yeah, Julianne Moore. When Julianne Moore like flies in naked and is like throwing paint on the ground and screaming, like, that's an interesting fucking person.
Yeah.
The next scene you have with her, she comes over to the dude's house and has sex with him so that she can get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Like these are things that just don't exist, but you like they have nothing to do with the plot. They have nothing to do with what's going on. It's like your hangout movie, but you're sort of following the dude as he's sort of moving around, and that's exactly right. You have all these weird, eccentric, and strange characters that are all building a world, but they're not important to the plot. You know, like that's why I say it's his Big Lebowski. And even to go back to like that moment where you're kind of like Donnie's murder in the Big Lebowski, like that's like a deep and dramatic moment in a movie that is primarily a comedy.
Yeah.
Like there's tons of shit to laugh at, and then you have this moment where you don't know anything about Donnie.
Yeah.
Except for he chimes in and they keep yelling at him. And then you feel terrible for him. And it's like the one moment of violence in the movie.
Yeah.
And that's what I kind of akin that ending scene. Because it could feel out of place, you know, the amount of violence that's going on. Aside from it being Tarantino and you're waiting for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But that scene sort of coming out of nowhere, it's sort of that. Like, they're just bowling and then the Swedes or whatever.
The nihilists or somebody.
The nihilists come out and then they're like, we want the money.
Yeah.
And then they fucking kill Donnie. Yeah. Like it's
like almost like an accident, too.
Yeah.
It's like an accident.
In Big Lebowski, you have a bromance between Bill Murray and Woody Harrelson, too. Right.
Yes, dude, right. Classic rye take.
It's really good. That's a great take, right?
Do you get the reference?
I didn't think about it like that.
Kingpin. Yeah. Yep. The joke was I was confusing Kingpin
the
with
Farley
Big
Brothers.
Lebowski.
Yeah, yeah, it's the Farley Brothers.
It's good. It's a good job. Anyways, let's try and salvage this.
Wait a minute.
But one reason I like bringing up how the audience watches it, not because like I'm an intelligent viewer or anything. I don't think I am. I have to like watch things over and over to order to have it click in my brain. But like I love his movies because they always like elicit some response from the audience. Mm-hmm. They're always like, oh, like you. I mean, you think about the moments, not just like the violent moments where you know the like bastards are they've got dynamite strapped to their leg and they're on this suicide mission, but like they get a real response, and it's like nice to hear when people like laugh together at the same things. Yeah, like you don't always, I mean, you get that with like the Marvel and Disney movies, of course, but like,
but those kind of somewhat feel like formulaic
like
in a way. There's almost like a da 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 joke. It's like
If I could just shit on the Marvel movies for 15 minutes.
I have no problem with Marvel. I'll say that right off the bat. Yeah, go ahead.
Just kidding. No.
That's Kenneth Beckerdite. I don't have a problem.
We go off a 50-minute tangent about why fucking...
Fucking Batman versus Superman, perfect film.
Yeah.
Right, no, but I mean, like...
Release the Snyder Cut.
Yeah, I mean, you can get excited, like, seeing, like, an Easter egg, or, you know, you see Iron Man pick up Captain America's shield, but with this one, you're like, it's just kind of like it's carried by the actors. It's just they're just emoting, and you're following emotional stuff. And I mean, there is violence in there, but it's nice to just see like people connect with it the same way you connect with it. I'm always interested in like talking to like you or anybody like going like, hey, dude, how did you feel during that scene? Like, how did you like? I want to see how you felt.
The reason I've been seeing it so much is because every time I go, I'm gauging the reaction of whoever I'm with. I'm gauging their reaction to the ending. And I saw it the second time with my brother, and he immediately got it and just like howling the whole time. And
the whole movie clicks there.
The whole movie clicks there. But then I saw it again with my friend Alex and his friend Mitchell. And Mitchell, he wasn't really like, I could tell like he was just kind of like watching the violence, and he wasn't like really applauding or anything.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay. So like and I asked him, he's like, no, it was good, but it just didn't give that like huge hurrah that I've been sensing. So like that's why I like I like going with people to see their reaction to the whole movie, but especially the ending. And especially the ending too, where getting more into just the actual ending, you know, when Leo starts talking to Jay Sebring behind the gate, and then it's still, you know, it's still like that. Yeah, we burnt the shit out. Yeah, I torched the last one.
Yeah,
it's still like really comedic dialogue. And the first time I watched it, I was just like really laughing. I was like, oh, the movie's ending. And then I was like, oh my God, like when he walks inside the house to get a drink with them, I was like, oh, that's fucking great. Just really awesome ending. And then the second time I watched it, I almost fucking cried because I'm like, fuck, this didn't happen. I was really thinking, I was putting it in the real world perspective. I was like, not, this didn't happen. Like, Jay didn't talk to Rick. Sharon didn't invite him up, and everything was okay. It was just, it almost like, I was like, wait, this is really funny and sweet, but it's extremely tragic at the same time.
Yeah.
And when the second time I watched it, when he goes up into the house with, I did cry because I was like, this is what, like, obviously, Tarantino has a lot of anger over what happened that night with Sharon and how a lot of innocence was destroyed there. A lot of like the foundation of like Hollywood was torn to bits.
Yeah,
and the 60s even was just torn to bits by that. You know what happened to her and all of her friends, and you can just tell like very clearly by it's almost like he's Cliff just killing these people that killed them, killing the Manson family that killed them. And you can tell, like, I thought, I was like, ah, damn, like, I could almost, like, feel his pain when that ending shot happens. Even though it's a great shot and it's really uplifting and light and, you know, and warm, when you walk back outside the theater, you're like, fuck, it didn't happen. You're like, God damn it, that didn't happen. And you wish that it fucking did. Like, you really want that, especially when they show you Sharon Tate, when they show you how... what a fucking light that she was with everybody who interacted with her.
Yeah.
And you're just like, fuck.
And there was a, I guess, touching moment when Brad Pitt gets into the ambulance. You realize that he was Edward Norton the whole time.
All right.
No, I definitely see what you're saying, Brandon, and I see what you're saying, Rye.
I think you see more what Rye's saying.
More what Rye's saying.
I was very surprised when Brad Pitt's character picked up Thor's hammer and just started smashing.
I was surprised. Yeah, when he pulled off his skin and it was Thor.
Yeah, it was actually a face-off situation. Yeah. Rick was playing Cliff, and they had switched during the into the third act.
In the sequel to Once Upon a Time, Luke Perry comes back from the dead.
Yeah. Once upon a time in Chinatown.
It's called Try Hard with the Vengeance.
Right.
Nice.
Try Hard.
It's pretty good.
What's
I forgot what I was saying. Doesn't matter.
But you're just talking about that last shot where he like walks inside their house and like, I mean, he gets what he wants. He wants to be in that inner circle. He believes that's where he's going to thrive. And like, that's one thing that kind of hit me at the end. not necessarily like in an emotional way, but in a way that's like thinking about like that year in Hollywood, like 1969,
yeah.
Like, which is just a crazy thing to like make a film about, you know, not just the Manson murders, but the moon landing and Woodstock and all these things. That year doesn't really make sense, you know, on the page, but you know, what year really does, I guess, with all those things going. The idea of just like meeting your neighbor is always like, I mean, we can email each other. We can like each other on Instagram and I can hit you up and go, hey, let's go grab a drink. But like the idea of just walking next door and going like, hi, I'm your neighbor. And that's,
hey, you want to have a drink? I'll invite you up for a drink and meet my friends.
It's a nice ending and it makes sense. And
normally
it's
just somebody's like texting or using the next door app to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
But instead, like Emil Hirsch comes down and is like, what the fuck happened? He's like, oh, I just burned some fucking Manson people. I just burned some hippies.
Is everybody all right? Very cool. And when fucking hippies ain't. Like, it's so good.
It's a simple ending to just kind of like check in on your neighbor and go like, hey, you all right? You want to come up?
Yeah.
Cutting back to the lunch with Leo and
Pacino.
At one point, Leo plays with his fork when he's feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's kind of like playing with your phone when you're uncomfortable.
Right, yeah. And then his stutter is incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Because they play it so light. You notice it, but they play it so light, and you sympathize with him immediately because you see him as this actor, and you're expecting to see him in his best off camera as well, even in the movie, because we're watching Leo play Rick.
Yeah.
Right? So he's supposed to be acting like Rick. We're supposed to be seeing the best. But Leo does such a great job of like sort of tastefully giving us a buffoon. You know, he's a movie star, but there's a reason why he's not a movie star. It's really because he's got charisma, but it's not enough to take him to the point of like Hollywood status. Like you can see that on him. His insecurities don't allow him to go past movie star to legend, you know, and that's even clearer. Like, it's funny to me as a smoker, that scene where he goes and talks to the girl and he's like, can I sit there? And she goes, you know, I won't bother you. And they sit down next to each other. And it's so cool because you always see, we were talking about how we see all these actors smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
But that's literally, as a smoker, what you do when you sit down. You're just, just like trying to breathe. Like the way he played a smoker, and that's how actors are. Like when they're not on TV, if they're smoking and shit, that's how they are. Like he was sort of demystifying the Hollywood actor in a lot of ways and breaking that thing down. And then what you have next to him is the next iteration of actor, the method actor, because that's something that's coming up. She goes, I like to use my character's name.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't like to eat. Yeah.
The fact that she's 8 years old.
She has a method and a theory, and Rick doesn't have that.
Yeah.
Rick doesn't have any of that. He's just concerned about staying in Hollywood. Yeah. He heard something from somebody once, and he is considered a failure if he has to move away from Hollywood.
Yeah.
And that's his guiding principle. That's his guiding light. And then you have this girl over here with a whole theory and practice, and like, she represents new Hollywood or represents something much different than him. And that's why it's so important for him to nail that fucking scene.
Yeah.
You know, it's so important because he's like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah.
So yeah, it's just shit like that. I know a lot of people were sort of peeved by that moment because the whole Lancer thing, because he does it in such an interesting way, but it almost seems like, well, yeah, this has nothing to do with the plot.
And but it's
like,
does.
It has so much to do about his character and the plot. He needs this. It's like, you can't get away from that part of it. And which is why it's brilliantly cut back and forth between the Spahn Ranch scene, is because, like I said earlier, I do believe that Bruce Dern or George's character represents old Hollywood that Cliff is coming to, and then Leo is now dealing with new Hollywood, which is like, put on a mustache, put on hair, you're gonna look like the Hell's Angels. Nobody gives a fuck. Like you're walking in, because the next iterate, because Hollywood was also at that point in time leaving Westerns and going towards bikers.
Yeah,
that was the big thing. So when the director is like putting shit on Leo and Leo doesn't understand, is because Leo is a dinosaur. This guy is trying to get him to be, I don't want them to see Rick Dalton. I don't want them to see Jake. I want them to see a biker and all this other stuff. So that was, the Western was turning into like this biker phenomenon. And that's what you're seeing the very early cusp of. These guys are edging out. And every single decision Tarantino put in there, it seems senseless. It seems weird. It seems just funny. I mean, the scene's just funny. But if you know a little bit about film history, that scene is actually really deeply insulting towards Rick as he's trying to put this whole fucking puzzle piece together.
Yeah.
He feels abandoned. He's feeling abandoned. And so the performance just becomes so much more heartbreaking for him. But then we save Sharon, you know, he saved Sharon Tate. We beat the shit out of him. You know, like, well, that's what I'm saying. It's like we gave Rick the ending he deserved.
Yeah.
You know, like he, I mean, Tarantino gave him the ending that he deserved and the ending that everyone really deserved.
Yeah. Yeah. And the, one little like note too is, do you remember how in the beginning when he first sees Sharon and Polanski and he's like, all I have to do is I'm like one pool party away from getting a movie with Polanski. Mm-hmm. And then he ends up killing the Manson girl in the pool. And then he's going to go talk to Sharon, and then he's probably going to be in Polanski's movies because he's talking to Sharon, and he's friends with Sharon and Jay, and then Polanski's going to come back from Europe after he's done filming that movie, and then he's probably going to be like, Sharon's going to be like, oh, do you know about Rick Dalton? And then next movie. I mean, that's a very, 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 like, that's a stretch.
No, that's a pool party.
That's what I thought. I was like, oh, wait.
That's a pool party.
I was like, yeah, he was, yeah, but,
pool party.
But yeah, just like, I don't know, like, obviously the ending's, like, really, really great, but I just, now that I've seen it a few times, I'm like, this is super bittersweet, and I think it kind of has to be that way by design, because
of it not actually happening.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, with Inglourious Basterds, that's, like, that's almost, like,
That's almost fetishizing revenge to the point where it's like, because it's so abstract. Like Sharon Tate's so specific. That event's very specific.
Yeah.
When it comes to Hitler, it's like Hitler is an abstraction to us. I don't care how anyone. I mean, this is why we have Nazis running in the street again. It's because they don't actually understand. Like, this is not about history. This is about an idea.
Yeah.
That this person represents, right? And so, like, Sharon Tate, and I think the reason why it rubs people the wrong way versus, like, a Hitler or when he does that historical revisionism, which is, like, Sharon Tate almost, you know, like, everyone knows about Hitler. Some people know about Sharon Tate. It just feels more localized.
Yeah.
And deep, more personal, way more personal to Quentin.
That's what I'm saying is that the ending, the whole movie feels extremely personal to Quentin.
Right.
To the point of, that's why I'm saying the ending is like, this is very clearly Quentin's anger that this happened to these people.
Yeah.
And he's longing for this to be what happened. Like he it's almost kind of funny. It kind of reveals something about Quentin as a person in a way, because his whole life is movies, and he finds he finds refuge in movies. He's been obsessed with movies since he was a kid. He worked at a video store. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of movies. So you kind of start to realize what movies really mean to him. It's like a way, not only is it to escape, but it's in his own mind. It's almost like to deny. It's like he's creating his own
version. Interesting, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like he can't. And this isn't an insult, but what I'm saying is that it feels like he has a problem accepting really the reality of the world and how brutal it can be. So he goes to movies and when he makes his own, he almost wants to just change how brutal the world is.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
because
any other person who made this movie, they would have just been, this is what happened, and this is inspired by a true story, and Sharon Tate died. There's been so many movies about that are like made by people that are like, we have to follow because this is how it happened in the world. And same with Inglourious Basterds, same with any World War II movie. The Schindler's List, this is what happened, this is the people, and all the downfall, this is what happened in the bunker with Hitler, and it's all factual. But he makes a very, very, very deliberate choice to say, fuck all that, movies are my life, and I want my life to be better than the reality of what these horrible tragedies were.
Right.
And he has characters like sort of displaying that, even with like the Manson like gang saying like, these are the people that taught us violence. Like,
yeah.
It's sort of like, we think it's like about us and this is the way we deal with reality. And it's sort of delusional, you know, in a way it's also just like a weird coping mechanism that we kind of play in our head going like, I wish it was like this. I like living here rather than living in this reality.
And that goes, like you're saying, that also goes like to the main characters. They long for, they don't like hippies. They don't like all this new shit. They don't like being...
it's a new era of LA. This, yeah.
They don't like the reality of the situation that they're in. And almost Rick is kind of a reflection of Quentin in a way, because he wants to escape his life, which is an alcoholic, which is, you fucking drink too much. Yeah. Fucking, he's super insecure, and he escapes into this badass fucking character. And then when he fucks up, when he snaps out of that role, it's just like he goes back. He's like, I fucked the whole thing up. I fucked it up. He's like turning into a kid. And like, because that's the reality of his life. And then he's escaping into these roles that just kind of, to me at least, the same way Quentin's escaping into this movie.
Or like he's, yeah,
you know, he's crafting his own world and his own narrative about these real events. That
what year did the movie take place?
1969.
Do you think he chose that because he loved 69ing?
You know what I think would be a really interesting double feature, which is is to start with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and end with Inherent Vice. Because yeah. I think they're both in dialogue with each other in terms about a message of the era. Because like Inherent Vice is definitely something about the paranoia mm-hmm. of the, you know, the institution of the government yeah. being so freaked out about the Manson murders. You know, and so you're that paranoia drives the movie
yeah.
so much, and then you have this movie before that. If you were to watch it, it's like, well, that's non-existent. You know, like they're both playing on the before and after of it. So I'm wondering, and they're both obviously completely fictional, but
yeah,
and that well, just to kind of like build off of what you guys have both been saying about like even like Charlie Manson thinking that a song was about him, or like you know,
the whole entire Helter Beatles Skelter. Album, he thought the whole album was talking to
was,
him.
Was talking about him,
but
and like
specifically Helter. Like that's the one that's mentioned all
but
the
that's
time.
Like that's like that's a real thing. Like you what did I just watch? I just watched on Netflix, there's a documentary that's pretty new. It's called Above Us Only Sky. Uh-huh. And it's about John Lennon and Yoko.
Yeah.
And him recording Imagine. Oh, you saw it?
Oh wait, no, not Imagine.
Oh, okay. It's like it's I mean it covers Imagine but other things. But there's a moment where there's a vet from Vietnam who just writes him and says, "Hey, I'm coming to your house. I'm coming mm-hmm. to visit you." And so John like just allows this like kid who like kind of looks homeless. He's like kind of dirty and like he's just hanging out and he's just like, "Hey, did you write this song about me?" And he's like, you know, and there's like a camera crew like filming it. Mm-hmm. And it's like a real serious scene where John and Yoko like sit out front of their house and they're just telling this kid like, "Look, man, like I just write music about like the shit that I had this morning. Mm-hmm. I write music about myself. I write music about Yoko. It wasn't about you." And mm-hmm. the guy's like, "How could this be true?" And it's like this poor kid really thinks that this song was written about him. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you know, John's really sweet and it's like, "You want to come in and have breakfast?" And they mm-hmm. like bring the kid in, they like, you know, feed him. And
yeah,
but that's a real thing. And I, you know, you don't really hear about that nowadays, like having
a
song.
No, you do. I mean, that's the guy who shot up the Aurora Theater.
Okay,
thought
yeah.
he was
I mean,
fucking Heath Ledger
right.
or the
it
Joker, you know, like this.
Different forms,
yeah. I mean, the
guy that tried to assassinate, Reagan, he went to Paul Schrader, the guy that wrote Taxi Driver.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he same thing. He went into Paul Schrader's office and was like, "Hey, how do you know me?" He was like, "What do you mean?" Paul's like, "What do you mean?" He's like, how do you know who I am?" Like, and he's like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Well, you know who I am. Like, how do you know who the fuck I am? It doesn't make sense. Like, you know my life, and how do you know
this
my
was
life?"
Off a Taxi Driver?
Yeah, it was off a Taxi Driver. And Taxi mm-hmm. Driver's about a guy that's very, very unhinged, and he's very lonely, and he's, you know, his routine is very fucking. It's just like, I don't know. It's just the whole movie is just about him being completely withdrawn from everybody and hating society and all this shit,
and then becoming obsessive to the point of
becoming obsessive with politics and taking down this what he sees as like this thing that is corrupt, and he wants to save something.
He wants to save the girl.
Yeah, he wants to save
you
the girl.
Know, like it is a sort of like a Romeo or Juliet or like a knight in shining armor kind of thing. But you're like, as an audience, we're so distant from him based off of the writer and the director that we're going like, "No, you're insane."
Yeah. Like, well, the thing is that guy, that's why he thought Paul Schrader knew about him. And Paul said...
Yeah, he's an incel.
Yeah, Paul said, you might think like what you're going through is entirely unique, but it's not. People go through what you're going through all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just something that a lot of people don't talk about. And the guy just left. And then I think it was a few months later, he was on the news for having tried to assassinate Reagan the same way that Travis tries to assassinate that president, the candidate.
What was the Catcher in the Rye one? Like somebody thought that was like
that was the guy who killed Lennon.
Mark David Chapman.
He thought that Holden Caulfield. He thought the book was written about him, I'm pretty sure. And the whole thing was when they found him after he shot John Lennon, he literally just sat and waited for the police to show up after that. And he started writing chapter 23, I think it is, or 27, because there's only 26 chapters in Chapter 23. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he wrote, like, for his chapter, he was like, this is my statement or something like that.
Yeah.
And because he thinks the fucking book's about him, and he thinks that, like, I need to write the final chapter to my story.
Right.
So yeah, it's just a lot of people like kind of getting absorbed in fiction and thinking that it's tailor-made for them.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen Under the Silver Lake?
I haven't seen that. No.
You should watch that one. It's not great. I didn't personally love it. Some people love this movie, but it actually gets into that, like the coded messages within music and then where is that systemic from and all that other stuff. Yeah. And it actually gets into what we're probably more talking about, which is more about Charlie Manson as a person than the movie. But
we should wrap up soon. We've been going for a while.
Well, I want to hear some thoughts from Rye. Actually.
Yeah, because
I feel like we've just kind of neglected Rye a little bit, and
well, for good reason. Yeah. I mean, he's shouting out
obscenities
about you,
Edward Norton.
I don't really have much to say. I like the movie a lot.
Nice.
Dude, that was so poignant. Like,
yeah, dude, I love that analysis of the movie.
I loved it.
No, I mean, but
and this
like,
is by
really...
your favorite director, Michael Mann.
I'm not as into film as you guys.
I get that.
That's okay. You
but you
be.
Can still read a film. Like, you watched it. Everything. Yeah. Like, none of this conversation's above your head, so don't think you're stupid.
No,
don't
you're
think
picking
you can
up.
Have...
You're
I'm not.
You're
actually, you are.
You're actually one of the few people that actually probably, this point that we're trying to make, where you go into movies and your enjoyment of the movie is kind of based off of the how it makes you feel in regards to your own life. You're talking about AI and how subconsciously that movie made you feel, because it's a Pinocchio story about a kid that loses his mom, and you're like, oh, like I felt like I was losing my mom.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why that movie it clicks for you. For us, we think that movie's fucking weird. You know what I mean? Like we're like,
dude,
or, I mean,
speak for your fucking self, man. I don't know.
I'm speaking for you guys, but I'm like, this is odd. I didn't gravitate towards it because you find the reason you like it, I think, is different than us.
Yeah. Well, as an alcoholic, I think everything's about me. No, but yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Which is also why I like the movie.
Go ahead. Come on.
Swingers?
No.
You know what you are? You're the type of guy who...
I like the movie Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Eraser?
Okay.
I can relate to his character.
You're kind of like the guy who likes Fight Club, right? Like, that's your... You're like, no. I'm really cool because I like Fight Club.
No. Well, let me ask you something. Who, for everybody here, who's, like, someone you like watching movies with because of just how they respond to like what they're seeing, like whether it's like they're like screaming or they're talking the whole like who do you like to watch movies with?
I guess Vincent Marcus, because he laughs at the same bad scenes as I do.
Mm-hmm.
Like we recently watched Nicolas Cage movie Drive Angry. We watched part of it.
Love it. No, it's yeah
and it was absurd and we were laughing at the same angry. Things Brandon. And also my cat Ralph.
Brandon?
My brother and my mom. Those two. Yeah. I like watching movies with them. My dad falls asleep during everything that's not
my
fucking,
dad does the same
like,
shit.
Action.
Yeah.
He's,
yeah.
I like watching movies with him too, because whenever I watch something with him and he's fully invested, I'm like, fuck, this movie's working on a level that I don't even understand. No, my dad's not falling asleep. Yeah,
yeah. That's how I knew Hot Fuzz was good. I was like, am I full of shit? My dad's like, that had everything, action, comedy, da-da-da-da. And I was like, damn. So like Edgar Wright got my dad on his side.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Yeah, but those are my people. What about you?
Actually, John, not just because you're here, but the scene where they're watching him on FBI, even from, like, I had text John, and I was like, that's what, we were living in that, in Studio City in the same room with each other, and that's what we would do. We would, like, do little marathons or something like that, and we would just comment and pick apart the film and stuff like that, and it's cool, because, like, you know, you, like, we don't always watch, like, the, like, we made plans this week to go see Hobbs and Shaw and stuff like that, like, like, this guy is the only person that's, like, completely in line with my tastes.
Yeah.
Like, just completely in line with my tastes, so it's a lot of fun to go watch a movie with John, because we're, like, we're just, we're there. Yeah,
yeah. John's, I mean, like, I definitely feel the same way.
So I was John's like, well, I was going to say my girlfriend.
It's like that scene with, like, Key and Peele where he's like, who's your favorite actor? And he's like...
No, I definitely feel the same way. I also like watching movies with my girlfriend as well. Like, I think both of you are like... Like, you guys have, like, the same taste.
Yeah.
Like, it's like... And I met them at the same time, which is weird. You know, it's like, talk about being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
No, I like, you know, like, cause he, like, even, I think I could hear you laughing at during this. We didn't get to sit together cause he got his tickets later.
I essentially watched it by myself 2 rows away.
But I could still, like,
every time a great moment happens, you just look up. He's like, ah,
no, I mean, that's kind of like, but that's what makes it a great film. It makes it memorable is, like, the people that you watch it with and, like, hearing your friends, like, laugh and, like, take in the moment with you, I think just connects you on, like, a different level.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's why I suggest, like, seeing it with a bigger audience, you know, and so it's we go see the Purge movies.
Oh yeah,
and, like, everybody is just ritual. Cheering like they're watching Gladiators fight.
Opening night.
It's kind of scary. you're kind of like weirded out with the audience because you're like, am I gonna get out of this theater? Like, okay, like everyone's like ready for death, and it's like
the first we went and saw the first Purge together on Thursday night, and we can end this because I know we're going on forever, but this was just one of my favorite movie experiences. I was working at the movie theater at the time, and everyone's like pumped up. This is the first Purge, like, everyone's ready for murder. There was fights in the, like, right outside the doors, like, because we couldn't let anyone in yet for this, like, midnight screening. I was getting off, so I was like, I don't have to deal with this shit. I'm getting off. I'm gonna go watch Purge. And it was like you, me, and Juan, right?
Yeah, Bree went with us.
Oh yeah,
too.
Bree. Okay. Yeah. So then we go and sit inside. And the movie, I mean, these people were ready. They were, like, fighting. Like, the energy was palpable. Like, they thought they were the fucking Purge. Like, Purge was happening fucking tonight.
Yeah.
This is not a movie. This is real. And, like, when we were in the movie, it was getting closer towards the end of the movie, this baby started crying. I don't know how
someone
this baby got in there.
Someone brought a baby to, like, a late night screening of the Purge.
But this guy was in the top row middle.
Yeah.
And the baby's screaming, and the audience was turning on him. They're like, get that fucking baby out of here. Like, I thought this guy was going to die. Like, it was like, but that was the energy of the audience. And that might be terrifying, but it's one of my favorite experiences. Say what you will about the film, but the film is heightened by how people are reacting to it, no matter what.
Totally.
Yeah.
Can I just add one more thing before we wrap up?
Sure.
I love the idea, just to kind of keep building off this, of like seeing a movie with an audience, like, because it reminds me of like going to the theater as a kid.
Yeah.
And we had this like crappy little theater, the Marketplace 16. Oh, and our friends' parents would like drop us off, and like they'd have to like sign us in for like rated R movies
and shit.
And the theater would just be packed, like the lobby, like the concession stand, just packed with people who were like, either there was a fight like happening that night that broke out, like
high school politics,
but it's also like I was like pretty young, like going to the movie. I just wanted to be there, and going into the theater. I remember seeing the movie Prom Night. If you remember that movie, it's just crabby, like whatever. But we like sitting in the theater. Everyone's just like yelling at the screen, and some dude started just like lighting up a joint in the theater, and you see just like smoke with the projector, and everyone's like, "What the fuck?"
This was not like, a very well maintained. This is not the Burbank 16. Yeah. Okay, this is City Walk. This is like
I felt like I was just like in a different time.
Wild West.
Totally. Yeah,
where just like it's there's a feeling of just like everyone's in this moment. We're alive. We're watching a fucking horror movie.
Yeah. I felt that way with the sequel to The Strangers that came out last year. Mm-hmm. That was one of my favorite movie-going experiences ever. The movie was not that great,
right?
But it's so schlocky and campy that it, like, the whole audience, just when shit would happen, just yell at the screen. And I was like, oh, usually I like kind of get annoyed by that, but this was like, oh, this is fucking awesome. It feels like I'm at a drive-in or something. Yes. It feels like I'm... in a different time. Yeah,
yeah, it's like, exactly. It's like it's communal in that way, and like we're all eating popcorn, which is like the loudest food ever. Like
it's disgusting. It's overpriced. Yeah. It's like the only thing that saves it is salt and butter. It's like, almost a nothing meal.
We were just talking about this. Like,
want to throw up after a large? Like.
Doesn't it make
popcorn kill your parents or something?
Like, doesn't it make
you popcorn?
You hate popcorn.
It seems like popcorn would be like an insult to eat during someone right? Like you're eating it loud, and someone's like, "You're watching my movie. Why are you eating the loudest food possible?" Like, yeah. I love that. I wish we still threw tomatoes at the screen.
That'd be cool. People do throw popcorn sometimes at the screen.
It's a little less messy.
Rye, I feel like you've been waiting to make a joke for a while. So go ahead.
Rye.
No, we've just been running for a while.
Oh.
He's going to have to cut all
That's the longest you've run for a while, huh?
We have to stop at 2 hours and, what is it, 2 hours and 45?
45 minutes. We can't go longer than the actual movie.
That's the joke I wanted to make. I said twice we've been running for a long time, so one of you would ask me how long we've been going for, then I say 2 hours and 45 minutes.
I did not mean to steal your joke.
Violently.
Can we do this next week?
Okay, so to wrap it all up, since we started with one word.
You've been running for a long time.
I know. Since we started with one word, let's now go around and say what we've been, like a sentence.
A sentence?
No, let's just go around and I don't know. What would you place this on his filmography, like on Tarantino's, like, what would you rank it? I mean, like, it's early, so it's kind of hard to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Top three.
Top three,
top
okay.
Three for you? Okay,
I think it's going to slink up there, too.
Yeah.
I think it was like, you know, there's the obvious Pulp Fiction. So I'm a huge fan of Jackie Brown.
Yeah,
so
Jack
that's
good.
That's usually my top one. So it's like Jackie Brown, maybe Pulp, and then this. And yeah, that's... But I feel like it's going to... Over the years, this movie is going to slink up there more and more and become one of my favorites from him.
It's definitely up there for me. I don't know where it ranks right now, but I definitely enjoyed that it was something that wasn't like based in revenge. And it was more about friendship. I definitely sort of lean toward that subject matter a little bit more than I would like run toward anything like violent.
Dazed and Confused with the Mansons.
Really what it feels like.
Something like that. Yeah, I always like run toward those kind of whatever that is. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say kind of same as Ken's. Like, it's like, it might be second. It might be second because I guess I just love everything it's talking about more than what the other movies are. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like the other movies are very plot driven. Mm-hmm. And the other movies feel like Tarantino being a nerd in a way. So I love everything he's ever done with Django, with Inglourious Basterds, Kill Bill, but sometimes it's like you can see like it's like homage after homage of like, oh, this is a kung fu movie and we're literally going to put one of those blip noises in the middle of the movie to the point where I have to rewind and see if I'm going fucking crazy.
Yeah, he didn't even do the feature presentation thing that he usually does at the beginning where it's like, you hear it when she goes into the theater, but he doesn't even start his movie like that, which I think is like the first time he's done that.
But this is the first one that feels like he's making a movie about like actual like real people.
Yeah,
I mean, he is making a movie about real people because Sharon Tate's in it, but also just like Cliff and Rick are just very, they feel super well rounded, and they're just like really believable characters. Mm-hmm. And I also think that this one, like to your point, Ken, is I think this one's gonna age very well.
Yeah,
it's gonna be one of those like a Big Lebowski or something like that. That's gonna age like. Or like a Dazed and Confused.
It'll be midnight screening worthy.
Yeah, for sure.
I thought it was a little bit better than The Abyss, but not as good as Phantom Menace.
It's pretty good.
Phantom Menace, okay.
That must be pretty good then.
All right.
Slightly. I don't think I've seen Jackie Brown. I don't think I've seen that.
That's one of his lesser known ones. That's the one that he made right after Pulp Fiction that's very...
It's his only one that he based off a book. Everything else, it's like an actual, well, I don't know how close of an adaptation to it, but it's based off of a book by Leonard.
Adaptation was good.
Elmore Leonard called Rum Punch. Yeah.
I also like Death Proof a lot, too.
Death Proof's good.
I'm a big Death Proof guy. I love that one.
I've never seen that.
It's the one he made for Grindhouse,
contribution to that. It's like three scenes. It's an initial talking scene, a lap dance scene, and a car chase.
Was he just the producer on the vampire one?
He wrote that one. That was stuff that he wrote before Reservoir Dogs, that and Natural Born Killers.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Who's the girl in Natural Born Killers, Juliette Lewis?
Yeah, I think so. Doesn't she play in It's Always Sunny? She plays Gail Snail?
No, that's Mary Lynn Rice Cub.
Oh, okay.
Comedian.
Ooh.
Juliette Lewis follows me on Instagram.
That's cool. Very cool.
That's awesome, man.
And we'll end
She's
with
a Scientologist,
that.
Though.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Hot.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, we've been running for a while.
How long have we been running, Ryan?
Been running?
2 hours and 45 minutes.
Just like the, yes.
Yeah. Thank you. No. Can you stop treating me like I'm a fucking idiot? All right, I hate saying I'm sorry, Dad, at the end of these, so.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
Well, we
you like it?
I'm sorry, Quentin.
Well, we've been doing it for 2.5 years, though.
That's fine. I'm sorry, Dad.
I'm sorry, Dad.
Sorry, Dad. What the fuck? It's did you see the rotation?
Did we go at the same time?
You want to do it at the same time? Do it one more time.
I want our voices at
the same time. Okay, Rye, go.
I'm sorry, Dad.
I'm sorry, Dad.
I'm sorry, Dad. What the fuck?
I said I want our voices to be one. All right,
okay,
ready? All at the same time.
All
one,
at the same
two, three.
I'm sorry, Dad.
Sorry, Dad.
Oh, fuck.
Okay, you fucking asshole.